I'm rather convinced that the ultimate root of most marital problems is a struggle for power. A struggle for power. It may take the form of money. It may take the form of this or that. But at the root of 90 plus marital problems comes somewhere that control for power. And the rest of it probably is just sheer selfishness. But those may be somewhat synonymous. Paul is often accused of being a male chauvinist, a woman hater. But you'll find those terms often in liberal theological counseling books. But as was pointed out last week, Galatians chapter 3, there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female. You are all one in Christ. Paul says we're all equal. I'm not going to put it back on the board, but for those of you that were with me last week, remember the distinction I made between positional equality and being functionally identical. And that's the key as we go to the family. In Ephesians chapter 5, beginning with really verse 21 through the end of the chapter, Paul gives us the most detailed and precise discussion of the husband-wife relationship. The only thing that even parallels that in length would be 1 Corinthians chapter 7. William Hendrickson observed in this concept of headship that the headship of a woman is what he called a creational endowment. And what he meant by creational endowment, pardon me, is the phrase that Paul uses in 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 11 through 13, where Adam was created first and then the woman, and Paul seems to tie the divine order somehow to that creational endowment. Now, whether you want to tie it to the fact that Adam was created first, and therefore God gave him these responsibilities, or God knew he was going to give the man these responsibilities, therefore he created him first. It's a bit of chicken and egg syndrome, but there is this basic principle of creational endowment. That's simply the way God created his divine order. And I think we have to go no further than Genesis chapter 2 to find the birth of divine order. But we have to remember, and especially husbands, although I've seen wives who need to remember this, but especially we men, that headship in a marital relationship cannot work apart from submission to Christ. Headship in a Christian marriage is amok if we try to separate that from submission to Christ. Therefore, when I look at Paul's writings in Ephesians chapter 5, I don't like to consider that he begins his marital discussion in verse 22. I like to consider that he begins it in verse 21, where he says, "Submit yourselves one to another in the fear of God." Everybody is to have a submissive attitude one to another. Husbands to wives, wives to husbands, brothers and sisters to one another in the Lord. Because the greatest compliment that God ever pays any Christian is to call them a servant. If you want to have the highest title in heaven, if you want to have the highest title that God bestows on anybody, you strive for the title of servant. You don't strive for the title of father or elder or deacon or evangelist. You strive for the title of servant. That's true in the church, and it's certainly true in marriages. And I believe that the family cannot function without headship, but Christian headship cannot function without submission to Christ and to one another. In C.S. Lewis's book, Mere Christianity, he was talking about this concept, and he said, "There must be a head," referring to the family. Why is it the man? Well, firstly, is there any serious wish that it would be a woman? He said, as far as I can see, even a woman who wants to be head of her own house doesn't usually admire that same situation in other homes. She's much more likely to say, poor Mr. X, why he allows that appalling woman to boss him about the way she does is more than I can imagine. I do not think she's even very flattered if anyone mentions the fact of her own headship, end quote. I thought that was interesting. Even women who have husbands who unbiblically turn the reins of headship over to them, even women who unbiblically take the reins of headship from their husbands, tend not to admire it when they see it in another family. What does that tell us about what really is going on? Now, there are two avenues that you can take, aside from the biblical avenue, to this concept of headship. The first is to try to restudy the text in light of current political correctness. But if you do, you're going to find it very difficult to treat the text objectively and reach conclusions that the Bible teaches regarding the relationship in the church and of the family. The second approach is to view the Bible as kind of a work in progress, and that the message Paul and the writers are giving it is always in shift and limbo and has to be molded to fit current social trends. But I think that approach simply challenges and rejects the divine authority of Scriptures. Scriptures indicate there is to be a headship in the family, a headship based upon authority. That headship is to reside in the man, but it's to be a Christian headship that has woven around it a submissive attitude on the part of the man to his family and a servant heart inside that man. What does it mean to be head of the house? Well, most of us have a clearer idea of what that means before we're married than we do after we're married. Just like we have a better idea of how to raise children prior to having them than afterwards. But having said that, our own personal frustrations in the area of experience don't change what the Holy Scripture says. And I don't think the concept of being head of the house has anything to do with pecking order. It has to do with divine order. If we attempt to define headship by erasing authority from the concept of headship, then I think we're fighting the wrong battle. Without any doubt, to be head of a home has to carry with it authority. In 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 4, one of the characteristics of an elder is to manage his family well and to rule his home well. You can't do that without a measure of authority. That's why some of you who are school teachers have my utmost sympathy, because our society is asking you to teach without giving you authority. And it can't be done. It just can't be done in the church, in the school, or in the home. Now, when I say authority, I'm not talking Hitlerian authority. I'm talking about servant-hearted authority. Peter teaches us in 1 Peter chapter 3 that the husband's assignment as head of the home involves accepting responsibility, making decisions, protecting those he leads. And it's not in anybody's best interest, husband, wife, or children, to try to take that away from them. It is absolutely not in anybody's best interest. But there is a tremendous difference between the world's approach to demanding authority and Christ's approach to gleaning authority. And it all has to do with the matter of style. Now, there are two words in the Greek language that I think describe this. One of them is diakonos, D-I-A-K-O-N-O-S, which means to be a servant or a table servant. The other one is doulos, D-U-L-O-S, and it literally means to be a slave. Now, you remember when the mother of James and John came to Jesus and asked that her sons would have a place of preeminence and predominance in the kingdom? He said, literally, whoever wants to be first must be your slave. The greatest in the kingdom is the servant, is the slave. Now, I believe a Christian wife should be, number one, assertive. I believe a Christian wife does her husband great service if she is opinionated. And I believe a Christian wife serves her husband very well when she is proactive. But she must also be submissive. And those things are not a contradiction. You remember when Jesus in John chapter 13 washed the disciples' feet? When he did that in the first part of the 13th chapter of John, he did one of the dirtiest, least desirable, lowest status task of that day. I don't know what to really equate that to today. And if I have some ideas, but I'll just let your imagination fill in the gaps for that. But in John chapter 13, he performed one of the lowest, menial, humiliating tasks. And then he says, I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. I tell you a truth. No servant is greater than his master, nor is the messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them. He's talking about doing the stuff that nobody else wants to do. That's what a servant-hearted person does. I've seen so many examples of that in the last 10 days, I've lost count. Sisters in this congregation, mothers tending their children, serving them. Not a thing pleasant about some of the tasks that they've had to do. But a servant-hearted leader is one who does those. And for those of us that are husbands, it may mean we've got to decide whether we're too good to occasionally run the vacuum sweeper. Clean the eaves, to mop up water that's been spilled by the children. Perhaps those are some real practical ways of washing the feet, as Jesus did in John chapter 13. Now I want to move on, and I'm not going to quite pause for your comments yet, and talk a little bit about what I put on the sheet about an egalitarian marriage. And I don't remember exactly how I phrased it. I think it has something to do, does an egalitarian marriage work and is it biblical? If you're not familiar with the term, and as I'm using it, and as I think it's most often used, egalitarian marriage is simply defined as a marriage without any definite authority structure. And the husband and wife in an egalitarian marriage have equal authority. Sometimes these are called partnership marriages or peer marriages. You'll find those in some of the writings. And theoretically, in an egalitarian marriage, everything works at an equal level. There's no man's work, and there's no woman's work. There's just work. And the man and the woman, together, see that they get it done. Ideally, in an egalitarian marriage, the couple would not have to move, but usually, people that study these tell us that usually in an egalitarian marriage, the decisions are made by whichever partner earns the most money. That's not always true, but usually in an egalitarian marriage, money determines power. And remember, most marriages, in my humble opinion, are based around power. Now, you might say, well, that means the man's in control, but obviously that's not necessarily true. Both couples have equal rights to initiate things and in decisions. And advocates of egalitarian marriage tend to contrast that with what we would call, or what they call, pardon me, a traditional marriage. And a traditional marriage, from an egalitarian perspective, means a marriage in which child rearing is basically the responsibility of wives. Husbands have the final word on all decisions, including where to live, household responsibilities, and intimacy. That's what an egalitarian would consider to be a traditional marriage. Now, I don't personally think a Christian marriage is either egalitarian nor is it traditional. I find, from my examination of these, some positive traits for a Christian marriage in both models. But before I share with you those positive things, there was a lady by the name of... This lady's a professor of sociology, and her name's Pepper Schwartz. If I went to all the work to get a PhD, I wouldn't go by Pepper, but that's fine. But she did a study on egalitarian marriages, and she looked at several areas, and I didn't put these in your notebooks, but if you want to jot them down briefly, you may just want to listen. The concept of co-parenting, egalitarian couples often find difficulty in this co-parenting arena because at some point decisions have to be made, and human nature being like it is, two people don't always come to an agreement, because we get stubborn, and somebody finally has to make a decision. But in an egalitarian marriage, you have no authority structure, so you're at loggerheads. Decision-making tends to go to the highest wage earner, so really an egalitarian marriage has authority, it's just not based upon divine order, it's based upon money. Control, once again, of the marriage tends to gravitate toward the higher wage earner. Household tasks. Those who participate in egalitarian marriages seem to enjoy freedom from having to be confined to traditional men's and women's chores. They seem to have little problem if he wants to cook and she wants to mow the lawn. I don't have any problem with that. No, I don't. I like for women to mow the grass. And then you go to Subway. But she goes to point out that arguments over who's carrying the greatest workload sometimes becomes a problem. Because it's almost impossible, or she concludes it is impossible, for a relationship to occur without there being some authority. Now, I want to give you four things, and these are areas where I think the egalitarian model has some Christian aspects to it. For instance, egalitarian couples would say there's no reason that each partner can't specialize, but both are careful that one doesn't take over all the high-prestige, undemanding jobs while the other ends up with all of the classical stigmatized assignments. In other words, there's a sharing of the workload. What's the Bible say? Philippians chapter 2, verse 3. In humility, consider others better than yourself. Egalitarian couple would say the husband or wife should be full partners in parenting responsibilities. What's the Bible say? Ephesians 6:4. Fathers, don't exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the nurture and the training of the Lord. Titus 2:4. Young women, or older women, train the younger to love their husbands and children. It's a co-responsibility. And that's probably one of the things that many men in the church, and some in this auditorium, and some of them might be standing, miss this point that the men have a tremendous responsibility in the parenting role. Now, we go to work, and maybe if your wife is able to stay at home, she may spend more time with them, but that doesn't change Ephesians chapter 6, verse 4, when it says, fathers, bring up your children in the nurture and the admonition. Number three, egalitarian, would say that both partners should have equal standing and equal status in the relationship. I just quoted you Galatians 3:28. The Bible says there's neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female. You're all one in Christ. And egalitarians say that both spouses should have equal freedom in initiating sexual intimacy. Paul says exactly the same thing in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 3 and 4, and warns men and women that we're there for our mates. So I don't think the egalitarian model is all wrong. I don't think the traditional model is all right. What I want us to get at is this concept of the Christian model. Now, very briefly, I want to talk about submission. And briefly, because I think we're together on this. But in Ephesians chapter 5, for instance, when it talks about submission, and it does talk about the wives being in submission to their husbands, I again always want us to go back and begin with verse 21 of that chapter where it tells us all to be in submission to one another. And I have yet to see a marriage fail when both partners were striving to be in submission to each other. Now, I'll grant you it takes two. But I have never seen a marriage fail when both partners were submitting to each other. And I don't think I ever will. Because I just don't see how it can happen. Submission means to yield, to put oneself under. Too often we think of authority the way Tennyson described it in The Charge of the Light Brigade. Theirs not to make reply, theirs is not to reason why, theirs is but to do and die. That's not submission and it's not authority. The term submission is used in the secular sense to describe the rule of Nero, of military officers, other positions of domination. That's why verse 21 here in Ephesians 5 is so critical. In 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 5, Peter says, "Young men, in the same way, be submissive to those who are older." Does that mean if an older man wants a hamburger, all of the young boys have to run and get him one? No. It's talking about the yielding to the authority and the wisdom of those that it's been given. Headship, in the same vein, I believe, is submitting to one another out of reverence for God. Women, the reason you submit is because you first submit to God. And I believe the reason women who have difficulty submitting is that they haven't first submitted to God. And I also believe that may be the key why in most congregations and most churches there are more women than men. Because women have mastered this better than men. That doesn't mean we've any of us conquered it, but I think men have more difficulty with this concept of submitting to one another and to Christ than women. But we do see it rear its ugly head. To be the head of the home, to be head of the wife, is to take responsibility for leadership at home, and shame on any man that doesn't do it. And shame is not a strong enough term. It's a sin not to do it. And men, I understand that it's not always what you want to do. And men, I understand that many times in our lives we wish someone else, the buck would stop somewhere else. That's simply not a biblical option. Now I'd like to put this all together and then we'll stop for a few comments. I think we're going to miss the entire point Paul's trying to make about submission and headship and love if we're not careful. How did Christ get to be head of the church? Did he do it by strong-arming his way in? No. Did he say, look, I'm the Son of God, and I've been given the authority, and I'm here, and I'm going to tell you how to do it, and this is the way it's going to be? Well, in a slight sense, yes. But in the context of passages like Mark 10:45 and Luke chapter 22, verse 24 through 27, Jesus says, you became great when you serve, and I come among you as one who serves. Jesus took authority of the church by serving and by sacrificing. And that's exactly what Paul means when he says you're to love your wives as Christ loved the church. That's our model, guys. And we take the headship of the home not from a point of power. We take it from a point of having that authority delegated to us, and then we exercise it in submissive, serving love to our family. And few are there women who won't respond to that. There are a few. I've met a few, and you've probably met a few, but a vast majority of women will respond to that if it's done in a godly way. I believe that a lot of the conflict in the home is rooted in the desire for control. And when I counsel people that are having marital problems, almost always there will be these terms, I, and rights, rights, rights. And when you hear a couple starting to talk about I and my and rights, you know they've lost sight of their and my responsibility. A Christian marriage is one that's enveloped in two people having a tremendous responsibility and love for each other. And two people who've gotten to a level where they can no longer worry about what their rights are. I don't have any rights. As a Christian, I don't have any rights. Everything I have is from the grace of God. When I became a Christian, if I did it right, and I'm not there yet, but as I'm trying to become a better Christian, I trade in my rights, and for every right that I trade in, God hands me one more responsibility. And this is God's relational pattern. What does he say in 1 Peter chapter 5 about the elders? They're not to lord it over the flock. They're to be examples. They're to be servants. All an elder is a servant. All a good elder is a servant. I guess there's some honor with it, but that's in our heads. Being the head of a home is simply the opportunity to serve. Let me pause and see if you have any questions or comments. I have a little more I want to cover, but I've covered a lot, even though it's foundational. Tom? First Peter 3 and 6 was the question and asking for me to comment on. I think the first 7 verses of that chapter have to do with this relationship, if I recall. 1 Peter 3 and 6, even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. I'm sorry, I don't know why I laughed. It's just that's such a hot button for people. Even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters ye are, as long as he doeth well, ye are not afraid with any amazement. I think that's simply indicating that Sarah had a tremendous respect and honor for her husband, and that wives in a Christian marriage should have a tremendous respect and honor for their husbands. And if you'll allow me, though, we want to also tie that to verse 7, which talks about the husband's responsibility to the wife. Did you have a more... Okay. I would agree with that up to the point that there's certainly a difference between Christ and the husband in terms of correctness.
I mean, if there's a conflict between submitting to your a wife, submitting to her husband, and if that anyway conflicts her submission to Christ, then obviously we obey God rather than men. And I know you agree with that. But the pattern is there. I will agree with that. Marcia? And I read that little reading yesterday, and I know it was emotional for you when I did it. It happened to be a man, but the best father and the best mother in the world is still not both a father and a mother. But there is one wonderful, wonderful silver lining to this cloud, and that's the church. And if we have time, we'll talk about that. But one of the great things the church can do is help all of us, even if we have a complete family unit, help us all raise our children. And when we have members in the church that don't have the full complement, it's even more important. Headship is one of those things, and we're all like this. We sometimes don't miss it until it's not there. Brenda. I would agree with you that the husband is going to be accountable. I don't think you meant to imply. I think wives have an accountability there too. It is quite a team effort. I thought I had one. John?
Could you comment on how we might see this wife giving honor to the wife? That's part of the headship.
Okay. He's in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 7. It says, giving honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel. Well, I'll tackle the latter phrase first, because this phrase, weaker vessel, sticks in a lot of craws. I don't believe, and I've said this, it has anything to do with intellectual capacity or intelligence. I think it may have to do, number one, with physical. That's just a stated fact. And in some situations, men will be a little more rational, and women will be a little more emotional. So in those situations, a man might be stronger. But there are other situations where the woman's emotions make her more motherly in the rearing of the children, so that's a plus. In terms of honoring, I think this has to do with the concept of feeling a responsibility for her, for protecting her, for providing her, for extolling her as it's appropriate to other people. I think the whole conduct of providing for, caring for, and loving your wife and loving your wife's children is all wrapped up in this concept of honor. Did you have a specific? I think it's a lifestyle. Anne? In 1 Peter 3? Or Ephesians?
In 1 Peter 3.
Okay. Yes.
And being courteous, considerate, is another word, and over and
One of the best definitions of courteous that I found, and I wrote it in the margin next to that verse, is to be humble-minded. When you're humble-minded, then you're putting the other person first. And I've said it a couple of times and repeated it. The same things that work in a family are going to work in a congregation, because relationships are relationships. And I think that's why when God gives us the qualifications for an elder, one of the key things is how he handles his family. Sure easier. And ladies, some of you have a tremendous challenge in this arena, because you're going to have some of you, and I don't see any right now, so don't read this in, but sometimes women are in the position of Abigail and their husband's a jerk. Now, you can call him curlish if you want to in the King James, but that's a euphemism for jerk. And some have married jerks. But it doesn't change the Bible. As long as it doesn't interfere with your ability to be a Christian, you've got a responsibility. That doesn't condone jerkishness. It's just a fact. Some of you women are married to men who aren't as intellectually quick as you are. And I have some of you in mind. No, not Chad. He's back there pointing. But you know, it takes a really mature woman to implement this idea when it's obvious that she's a step or two quicker. But I think that's tremendous, tremendous godly womanhood when that happens. Let me just make a couple of comments here, and then I want to flash an overhead up here. Ladies, be very, very careful in this area of honoring your husband. And I know probably all of you try very, very hard, but it's not uncommon to see a woman dishonor her husband in very subtle ways. Facial expressions. I'll be talking to a man and his wife will be standing behind him and he'll be telling me something and she'll be going like this, or she'll be rolling her eyes. I mean, you may be right, but that's not a very honorable conduct. And men have to be careful on that regard too. Not the rolling of eyes. Men usually do it with their tongues, as Richard was talking about yesterday. Barbara. Okay, 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 14, where the woman, she says, is told to guide. Say that again, 1 Timothy what? No. 1 Timothy 5, 14, okay. I will therefore that the young woman marry, bear children, guide the house, and give none occasion to the adversary to speak reproachfully. I think that's speaking as it does in Titus chapter 2, that the women have a tremendous responsibility for the overseeing of that home and for the children. And I think they have a real guiding responsibility. Now, if there is a conflict in the direction the home's going to go, that ultimate decision has to rest at the head, which is the man. But the man's not there nearly as much as the woman. For every minute I spent raising our children, Donna spent 5, maybe 10. And I don't know all of what she did. Comment on that? I don't consider that to be usurping the authority of the man. They prefer what? Oh, sure. Yeah, there are a lot of women who don't want to do this verse. And those women either are lazy or, well, they're probably almost all lazy. I might as well go for it. But sometimes they hide that laziness in extracting themselves from the home environment unnecessarily. And sometimes that takes the form of a job. Sometimes that takes the form of volunteer work. And I don't think either one of those are wrong. But if it's done to extract oneself from the God-given responsibility of the home, then we got a problem. Pat, and then I'm going to move on. Okay, her question for the tape is, if a woman wants to read something or go to a program and the husband says, I'd rather you not get involved in that, what should be her appropriate response? I'll just give you my opinion. I think it'd be quite appropriate to ask why not and have a discussion of it. I think it would be foolish, unless it's something that you have to do for your Christianity, salvation, to cause that to be a strife point. But I don't think a husband that says, I don't want you to do it, and then doesn't explain his reasoning, is not in a headship role, submitting one to another and honoring his wife. But I think it might be appropriate for a husband to say, I don't think that's the direction we want to go as a family, and as you're a guiding influence. And I don't think it's inappropriate for a husband to ask his wife not to participate in some things. I've seen cases where I wished it were done. I've seen cases, my humble opinion, where the husband is literally scared of his wife, and off for various reasons, and I'm going to stop there. But I think that's an abdication of leadership when you're that way. I was going to put another overhead up, but that's not going to, we'll just start there. Go ahead, Glenn. I'm sure glad we didn't miss this. Let me go back to Pat's comment, because I since I've got 5 minutes and I don't want to start in on anything. Ladies, I think there needs to be, you need to have some discernment and care. There is a lot of garbage out there that's trying to get its spiritual clutches on you. And most of it is emotionally based. And it has a greater appeal, since it's emotionally based, to women than it does men. So I would simply say, and I'm not commenting about any single thing, because it would vary. I just say, be very, very discerning. Because most marriage and family-oriented tapes, books, are bought by women. 90% of the family marriage and tapes and books are bought by women, just like 99.9% of the romance novels are bought by women. And it's often trying to fill in an emotional void, but it's awful easy when emotion is our primary focus to get pulled in a direction. And I'm not against it all, I'm just saying be very, very careful. I say the same to men. I just personally think it's a greater threat to women than it is to men, because of this tremendous ability to empathize and sympathize that women have. And that's a tremendous thing. I don't want you to lose it. I'm just saying that strength can also be your weakness. Brenda?
Thank you.
I think it's called immersing yourself in the Word of God and prayer.
We need to help them.
Immersing yourself in the Word of God and prayer, and help them up to the point of interfering with their marriage. Interfering with their marriage. And I know after we're married it's too late, but I keep coming back to how important that selection process is. Usually a jerk doesn't just wake up a jerk. The seeds were there before. But we can mask it. We can mask it. And it goes both ways. You know, a guy marries a woman and she used to spend 3 hours getting ready before the date, and then he comes home from work and she's still in her robe. It can work both ways. You know, what's that old adage? And some of you have heard me say this. Every marriage starts out with a prince marrying a princess and ends up with a bald man married to a fat lady. We change. And maybe some of that we could control. Tim and then Chad. You want to ring the buzzer there? Go ahead. I think that's pretty good. Tim says, in a nutshell, we should defer to one another and yet accept responsibility. And when a decision spiritually or for the family has to be made, that responsibility ultimately lays at the man's feet in a Christian-modeled home. Now, when you're married to a non-Christian, it makes it much more difficult because you're not, ladies, you're not going to get spiritual guidance from a non-spiritual man. I'm not saying it can't work. I'm just saying you've taken on a bigger load. You've taken on a bigger load, or you've been left with a bigger load. Chad? Yeah, well, I'd agree with you most way. I want the family to raise our children, and I want the church to raise our children. I don't want the village to touch them. And that doesn't mean homeschooling. You can send them, but you know what I mean. And that's exactly part of the big problem. Families are expecting the community and the school system to raise their kids. Some of them are expecting the church to raise them. And I conduct VBSs, and these other guys do, and parents send their kids to VBS, and then they never come back. Or parents want to make sure their kids get to church, but it's not important enough for the parent to get to church. The church cannot do what the family undoes every day. And I tell parents this. I said, I can't come in and have a VBS in 1 week and raise your children spiritually if for the other 51 weeks of the year, they're never going to get anything. And that's back to Tim's comment about accepting our responsibility. It is not your responsibility to raise my children. It's mine. I appreciate all the help you can and have given me, but it's my responsibility, our responsibility. Absolutely. Tomorrow we're going to cover myths about marriage and blended families, step-parenting. We'll spend a half hour on both. I promise.
This one's not on.
You want me to start all over? Melinda and Mary are the ones that really needed this session, and they haven't heard it. But maybe we can get it on tape for them. Gerald especially wanted me to cover this when Melinda was here. Thank you, ladies. Could you hear me? Okay. Maybe I'll just turn this one off. Okay. That may have messed up the taping, but we'll see. Okay. Where was I? Oh, one special person for me. I don't believe that, and I don't believe that's a biblical concept. I believe there are special people that are best suited to be our mates. But I don't believe it's a biblical concept, and I don't believe it's a logical concept to believe there's that one special person out there for you. Otherwise, the Lord wouldn't encourage us to remarry if we lose a mate. If there's only one person out there for me and something happens to my wife, then there's no use me even looking. Now, certainly there are people best suited for us, and that's the dating process. And that's why it's important to be looking around during that process. But I believe marriage is 90% commitment to making it work and 10% finding that one singular person that makes you the most happy. And this oftentimes leads to divorce, because people will get married and they'll say, this can't be that one person. So they go off looking. And then we end up with serial monogamy rather than polygamy. And serial monogamy is even more treacherous than polygamy. My marriage partner will make up for all of my deficiencies. Well, mine doesn't, because I've got too many of them. And your marriage partner can add to your happiness, but they cannot fix things in you that need to be fixed. Les and Leslie Parrott, who've done quite a bit of writing on this, have the following statement in their book. Couples who swallow the myth that their spouse can make them whole become dependent on their partner in a way that is, by all standards, unhealthy. These couples cultivate what experts call enmeshed relationship, characterized by general reliance on their spouse for continual support, assurance, and wholeness. Now, on the surface, that would sound like a good thing, reliance on our spouses for continual support, assurance, and wholeness. The problem with that is that sometimes life has to go on when we lose a spouse. And we can't get all of our wholeness from our spouse. Back to the concept that that's why we need Jesus Christ. There are no things that can't be handled, but most of the things that are deficient in ourselves have to be handled by us rather than our mate. And this gets into the concept of, well, I know this person has some problems, but after we get married, I can help them change. Well, good luck. They may change, but you won't change them. They may change, but you won't change them. And many a young lady has gotten married thinking that I'll change him, only to find out that hasn't worked. Our problems are so serious that there's no hope. Well, there are serious problems, but there are no problems that can't be solved. As one writer said, there are no irreconcilable differences, there are only irreconcilable people. And if you and I want our marriages to work, they can work as long as our mates are working with us on that. Now, I've never seen a divorce that was one-sided. I've never seen a divorce where there wasn't fault on both sides. I've sometimes seen a man walk away from his family, and I shake my head and wonder how he could do that, and I don't condone that at all, but when I look back into the history, I see a wife, that didn't do the things to nurture that relationship. And you can reverse that. I can understand a couple not liking each other anymore. I don't condone divorce, but I can understand that. But I will never understand a parent walking away from their children. Now, I'm not saying it can't be understood. I'm just saying I don't think I could ever understand that. We can't communicate. Well, communication is oftentimes a learned activity. But usually when people say we can't communicate, it really means we choose not to communicate, because people can communicate. Sometimes communication is harmed by failure to give full attention. Sometimes it's harmed by moods, beliefs, style, or self-protection. All of those are filters to communication. Husbands, your wives are going to want to talk to you. And it will be somewhat agonizing. But you need to listen. That's part of honoring her. It's part of honoring her. And it will become difficult. And it'll take all of your mental strength to focus on what's being said. But it's in your best interest to try to do that. And wives, you need to listen to your husbands also. And the last one I put up there is, we don't love each other anymore, so we need to stop making one another miserable. Well, the choice to not love is exactly that. It's a choice. If you don't love your mate anymore, or when someone says they don't love their mate anymore, what they are literally saying is, I choose not to love my mate anymore. Because love is commanded in the Bible. Therefore, it's a love of the will. I want to close this, my part of this, and then open it for some questions. But I ran across a term that was coined, at least to the first of my knowledge, by a man by the name of Paul Faulkner. And the term is a chewing gum marriage. I hadn't run into that, but I like it. A chewing gum marriage. What's a chewing gum marriage? It's a marriage when all the sweetness is gone, you spit it out and get another stick. And that's the way a lot of people view marriage. When that emotional rush, when that sweetness is gone, we just discard it like we would a used stick of chewing gum. Now let me pause and leave a few moments here. Comments on any of these or other myths or other misconceptions about marriage that you have experienced or you would like to share with us, or you think it would be good for me to try to make sure I bring them up when I'm talking downstairs, I'll just pause. Tim? Tim's question deals with the motivation behind the choice to love someone. I think the motivation behind love has to be wanting what's best for that person, because that's the definition of love. The motivation might initially start out to be a little selfish. I don't want to be alone. I want to be socially acceptable. And I'm not saying those are wrong motivations, but they tend to be a little bit selfish. But the ultimate motivation in my mind for loving someone is that I hold this person in such special honor that I want to do everything I can that is best for them, so that they can be the fullest and most complete. And then if our mates do that to us, then you've just got a wonderful symbiotic relationship. Jay?
When I've heard an excuse because I don't love them or hurt them more, I used to tell them, your life's not about the feelings, it's about the responsibility. Loving someone is a responsibility, especially a child.
Sure. There need to be feelings in a marriage. We don't want to make marriage sterile. But the ultimate maturity of marriage has to do with putting the other person first and our God-given responsibilities. Doug?
Another one I have heard is that children will fix it.
Okay, children will fix it. No, children don't fix it. We were in Ephesians chapter 5, starting with verse 22 down through 33 yesterday. And I said that's one of the longest expositions and concise that Paul gives us on marriage and the family. There's one thing that Paul never mentions in those 12 or 13 verses, and that's children. Because children are not to be the glue that holds the family together. And that's why you see marriage after marriage disintegrate after 25 or 30 years, because that's when the kids are gone. And if the kids are what's holding a marriage together and they leave, then what have you got left? Now, even if they're not what holds the marriage together, some of you have gone through, and Donna and I are now going through it, as the kids begin to leave, you go back and you kind of rediscover each other. You start doing things you used to do before the kids came. I mean, the things that you can physically keep up with. You know, you're about 25 years older, so you get home earlier, but you start going out. And it's important, we need more family-centered children and fewer children-centered families. And I was asked a question, so let me insert it. I think it might fit here. I was asked a question at the break to comment on prioritizing. And it was in the context, it was a woman that asked me, so I'll take it from that context. How should she prioritize her husband versus her children's needs? Well, ideally, that would never be a conflict. And ideally, and I hope in most of your homes, that's not a conflict because you and your mate are working toward. But if it ever becomes a conflict, unless it compromises your Christianity, I believe a husband and a wife put their mates first and children second. And many, many families fail when they do that. And much marital stress comes about because they're fighting over kids. I love my sons. But if I have to make a choice, that lady right there is number one. Because it's biblical. It's biblical. Children are a blessing that mold into a curse on occasion. And we have to be careful. We have to be careful. Fathers can spend all their time with their sons and their marriage falters. Wives can do the same thing. I'm not talking about child abandonment. I'm talking about prioritization. Tom? And let me comment on this, even though this isn't a parenting session. If your children are number one in your family, you're going to raise very selfish children who probably will have a great deal of difficulty in their interpersonal relationships. And that's why, and I know there's exceptions to this, and take it in the spirit that's intended, but that's sometimes a real difficulty for children who are only child, or children who are children of late parents. They are so focused on that in all of our good intentions, we make them very selfish. Chad. Good. Chad's comment is one of the best things you can do for your children is to love their mother. And that's quite true. Kathy. Sure. Money and kids are going to fix anything. Money and kids don't fix anything. They can be a blessing, but they don't fix a thing. They don't fix a thing. Dan.
To bridge over to the next category, not money family.
Yes.
The idea of loving your mate above the children is critical to a women's family.
Absolutely. Right, and I'm going to repeat that so we get it on tape, because that's an important thing. We're going to be talking about blended families. It's even more, if possible, it's even more important in a blended family to have that close husband-wife relationship. Otherwise, the marriage will suffer, the children will suffer, and it will be, rather than holy wedlock, it'll be holy deadlock, as one writer put it.